Hey everybody, welcome back to my channel. Thanks so much for tuning in. My name is Dana Trupiana, and I cover infamous gangsters every week in a true crime-like format. If you're new here, welcome. If you've been here before, I hope you already know how much I love you guys. I love interacting with you. I love the little family that I've built around me. And thank you guys all so much for all your love and support. So before we get into anything at all, I am going to stress this very heavily. I have chapters in all of my videos. Whether you're watching this video on YouTube or you're listening to a podcast, wherever you're listening, there's chapters. This is going to be a really long intro because it's been a long time since I've put a video out. So if you're one of those people that don't really care so much about me and you just want to hear about the gangster, that is totally, totally fine. Skip to the next chapter and you can get right into information on today's gangster. For all of those of you who are left, how are you guys doing? It's been so long since I put a video out and I've been so busy with work and doing these live shows and the giveaways and all of that kind of stuff. But I've missed you guys so much. Thankfully, I've gotten to talk to a lot of you guys in the live videos, but I always miss hearing your thoughts and opinions on the mobster of the week and having conversations with you regarding that kind of stuff. So we're gonna go ahead and get back into the swing of that right about now. This video is probably gonna be two parts because I know this intro is gonna be really long and I have a lot of information on today's gangster. So I'm sorry if you're someone who hates two-parters, but if it makes you feel any better, I have it set up where at the end of this video, YouTube automatically brings up part two, and you can click it and there's no break in the story. If you're someone who's watching this video the day it comes out or a day or two after it comes out, I hate to break it to you, but it's gonna be a week until part two comes out. But that's okay. I know you guys, you're strong, you'll make it, everything will be okay. Woosah. Okay, so what have I been up to? Well, first off, I have been sick as a friggin' dog. Like, I hate living in New York. I hate every single thing about it. But the thing that I hate the most is the fact that it's somewhere around 17 degrees outside right now. I cannot stand cold weather. I hate it. And every year growing up, I always got a really, really severe illness. Most of the time it was bronchitis, or I mean, I had a flu sometimes, but every single year I got some severe illness, and it always came during those like cold patches, which is what we're going through right now. So cold weather is my arch nemesis. And you know that age-old question, would you rather be too hot or too cold? Yeah, the only people who answer that they would rather be too cold are the people who have never really felt true cold. People who haven't been forced to lay in the dirt for 3 hours when it's 9 degrees outside and they're not even allowed to wear a sweatshirt and they're pulling security with pew-pews aimed at a random deserted forest. Anyone who has been there and done that will tell you that they would way rather be too hot than too cold. As long as you have water, you can always take clothes off to cool down. You'll be okay if you're too hot, but too cold, that gets into your bones, man. I hate it, and I hate living in New York because it's always there. Even if you're someone like me that doesn't really leave the house too often, it's always a problem. While we're on the topic, I have been heavily considering moving back down south. I know, I suck. I can't make my mind up. I go back and forth between the South, and when I'm in the South, I miss New York, and when I'm in New York, I miss the South. But honestly, I think I need to go back down there and make it permanent. I cannot stand this cold weather. I can't stand having to put oil in my house. I can't stand having air conditioners in the windows instead of central air. I hate everything about it. I hate the cost of living. I hate the misery on every single person that you encounter. It all just really sucks, and I really want to go down there, that happier, more relaxed vibe, that more relaxed way of life. So I think I'm going to have a house built somewhere down there, somewhere in like the Georgia, northern Florida area. That's where I was, like, down south. I was a bit more south than Savannah. And that's like, that's my area. It does hit like low temperatures there, but it's always in the middle of the night. During the day, the coldest I remember it ever being during the day was like high 40s. Where right now it is 1:30 in the afternoon and it's 34 degrees. When I woke up this morning, it was 19 degrees. Try letting your dog out in the morning in that kind of weather. Another thing that I hate about New York is that if I do have a house built down in Georgia, since I'm a 100% disabled veteran, I won't have to pay taxes on my house down there, as opposed to up here where I do have taxes on my house and it costs an arm and a leg just to live. The taxes in New York are so astronomical, like it's a barrier to entry to living here. It's crazy. And I won't have that down south. So I could spend double the amount of money on a house as I would in New York because my mortgage on a monthly basis will be that much cheaper. And that's not to say I would spend double the amount. I'm gonna enjoy having a lower mortgage. But to be honest, my income won't fall. My income is gonna stay the same whether I'm in New York or down south in Georgia. I work from home, I have disability from the VA. Nothing's gonna change, so I will be living a Georgia lifestyle with a New York salary, so I'm down. So anyway, what else is there? So I think I mildly touched on the fact that I am in my glow-up period right now. I got shots on my face, and I'm getting rid of all the indents and the scars on my face and all that. Well, another thing that I've been doing is I've been going to yoga twice a week. Holy crap. Yoga kicks my freaking ass. Everybody that thinks like, oh, it's just yoga, it's no big deal, you have no idea what goes into yoga. Yes, the frick it is a big deal. I break out in a goddamn sweat at yoga, okay? It is not easy. I've also been making these shakes and putting fruit in them. Well, honestly, I had my husband go buy the ingredients and I plan to make the shakes. And like, I'm wearing my retainer so that my teeth stay straight. I'm doing progesterone shots and I'm just doing a lot of different things to try to get my looks, my body, and myself to a normal place so that hopefully, eventually, I won't have any issues at all. That would be really cool, right? Other than that, for those of you who don't know, I recently hit 30K subscribers. I legit could not be more psyched. I can't. I'm so excited. It's absolutely amazing. I went from 20 to 30K really quick, and it took me years. It took me over a year to hit 1,000 subscribers. So the fact that I got 10K so quick going from 20 to 30K is amazing. I can't describe how I feel about that. It kind of froze right there at like 30K. I haven't really gotten through 32K. I've been stuck at like 31 point something K. And I'm totally cool with that. I'm thinking it's probably because it's been a while since I've put a video out and I'm not promoting any videos or anything like that. So let's see if we can get to 40K and do another giveaway with this video. I swear to God, I will scratch, claw, and bite my way to that 100K plaque. I will make it happen. There is nothing in this world that could make me not get that 100K plaque. The last thing that I want to talk about before I jump into this week's Mafioso is the new trend. All my Gen Z people, come on, you knew what I was going to say, right? You knew I was going to bring it up and that we were going to discuss it at the first chance I got. I know I was the first person that a whole lot of people thought about when they heard of this trend, and for good reason. What's the trend for my older viewers who are completely lost right now? Well, there's a trend on TikTok where mob wife aesthetics are now a thing. What does mob wife aesthetics mean? It means big fur coats. It means bright red lipstick. It means expensive perfume with cigarette smoke over it. And yeah, a lot of these real-life mafia wives are getting on TikTok and they're telling you why it's not a trend and you can't do it unless you have a husband or a family member that's locked up in prison and blah, 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 blah. Ignore all those people. I have been waiting my whole life for Mob Wife aesthetic to become popular, and I am reveling in it, baby. And as somebody whose first outing in my entire life, when I was, like, just born, was to a prison to visit a family member who was also a mobster that was in jail at the time, let me tell you, most of us that have had that experience, we're not offended that you rock the aesthetic without having the prerequisite family member in prison or dealing with the mobster husband that you know not to ask questions to because he's going out and cheating on you and you know that. If you don't have those prerequisites, you can still wear the big fur coats and you can still wear the bright red lipstick and you can still say that you have a mob wife's aesthetic and go for it. Don't let anybody dim your shine, baby, okay? And don't let these butthurt women tell you that you can't rock a trend because you don't have a family member in jail. Like, it's not a flex. I've been there. I have done that a billion times. It's not a flex, okay? So you go on and keep rocking that trend. Okay, so let's go ahead and get into today's episode, shall we? Our episode today is going to be on a man named Joseph Patrick Lombardo, also known as Joey the Clown, an American mobster. So picture this. It's a frigid New Year's Day in 1929, and in the heart of Chicago, a new player is entering the game. Meet Giuseppe Lombardi, who later went by Joseph Patrick Lombardo, but you might know him as Joey the Clown, Joey Padula, Lumbo, or even Lumpy. Yeah, this guy had quite the reputation. Now, Giuseppe was born in a cozy little apartment on Chicago's South Side, the seventh of 11 kids to Italian immigrants Michael Lombardi, who was 29 years old, and Carmela Partipiolo, who was 23 years old. And that is actually really wild to think about. His mom had seven children by the time she hit 23 years old. Can you freaking imagine? Can you imagine being 23 with seven kids? When I was 23, I wasn't responsible enough to own a car. No less like John and Kate plus eight in this bitch. Like, this is crazy to me. Mike, his father, was a tough butcher who left behind the vineyards and olive groves in Italy to carve out a future in the land of opportunity. And then there was Carmela, the heart of the family, the glue that held everybody together. Growing up in this household with 10 siblings, Giuseppe learned the importance of hard work, family, and tradition really early on. As young Giuseppe grew up, you could say he had a lot of street smarts. Growing up in Chicago, he soaked up the city's diverse cultures, languages, and all of the chances that were just waiting for him. He might not have seemed like your typical American dream story, but Giuseppe had ambitions that would lead him down a pretty unexpected path. As he grew into an adult, Lombardo's charisma and cunning started taking him in a completely different direction. He ended up getting mixed up in Chicago's organized crime scene, a world full of mystery, power, and danger. It wasn't what his parents had hoped for him. It's nobody's parents' dreams for their kid to become an infamous mafia killer. But there's plenty of them around, so it just doesn't go according to plan sometimes. Now, let's talk about Joseph Patrick Lombardo. Quite an intriguing character. They called him Joey the Clown because of his cheerful personality, but there was a lot more to him than met the eye. He dropped out of high school and made a small but significant change. He turned the I at the end of his last name into an O. This tiny little tweak symbolized a shift from ordinary to extraordinary. It was meant to Americanize his name, and little did he know, it would become his signature in the world of organized crime. In the 1950s, America was booming after World War II, and Joey found himself lured into the gritty underworld of Chicago. He couldn't resist the allure of the power, the wealth, and the brotherhood that came along with organized crime and the mafia. Let's talk about the outfit, the infamous Chicago Mafia. They were the mafia family of Chicago that basically ran the show when it came to all things illicit in the Windy City. There is a lot of gangs in Chicago, but when we're talking in respect to the Italian mafia and who is related to the New York Five families, who has a seat on the commission, we're talking about the outfit. We're talking gambling, loan sharking, extortion, racketeering, you name it, these guys, they have their fingers in it. And right in the middle of it all is our man, Joseph Patrick Lombardo. This guy's early career in the outfit was kind of like a crime smorgasbord. He wasn't just a one-trick pony. He wore multiple hats. One of them, a jewel thief, going after some seriously valuable bling and precious metals. Think high-stakes heists that required nerves of steel and meticulous planning. Joey had all of that in spades. But that's not all. He was also a juice lender, or a juice collector, which is mob speak for a loan collector or a loan giver. Now, loan sharking might sound like something out of a movie, but it was a seriously lucrative yet incredibly risky business, and it was very real. They would lend out money at crazy high interest rates to people who were in deep financial trouble. And if you couldn't pay up, you might not have the same kneecaps that you woke up with that morning, if you were lucky enough to wake up the next morning at all. In 1963, his criminal activities took a pretty dark turn when he got arrested for kidnapping and loan sharking. The whole thing started with a factory worker. This guy owed $2,000, and he had fallen behind on payments. But did our little clown go to jail after this? Of course not. The guy couldn't positively identify Lombardo as the guy who nabbed him. This led to a jaw-dropping acquittal in court. And believe it or not, that was the 11th time in a row that Joey had gone to court and dodged a conviction in 11 separate arrests. Lombardo's entry into the outfit was really fast-tracked. It didn't take long for him to climb the ranks, taking on more and more responsibility in the criminal syndicate. He was known for keeping up this friendly, joking demeanor, even in the middle of some seriously shady business. Hence the nickname Joey the Clown, which kind of masked his ruthless side that he had hidden beneath. And it gave the general public kind of an idea of him. Everybody thought that they knew who he was. When you thought of Joey the Clown, you thought of somebody that joked around and was your pal. And it was a very meticulously crafted public persona. Let's talk about one particular crime that took place on September 11th, 1965. Way before September 11th was a date that anybody associated anything with. Lombardo was in a crew that was led by Joseph Joe Gags Gagliano and William Wee Willie Messino, who were described as mob loan sharks, gamblers, and terrorists. Mandel Manny Scar, a mafioso in his own right, and owner of a hotel or two, was stirring up all kinds of trouble for Lombardo. Lombardo apparently stalked Scar for multiple days before Scar's untimely death. He was seen tailing him on both September 8th and September 9th, lurking in doorways and being a whole creeper the entire time Scar was wherever the hell he was. A cocktail lounge, a hotel, just living his life, and here's Lombardo just stalking him. Scar was staying in a motel under a pseudonym, Walter D. Pritchard, and while he's at this hotel, he's doing drug deals, he has people in and out. It's a great 5-day stay for Scar, who's currently occupying not only one, but 2 suites at this motel. Now, Scar had recently had an issue with Rocco DiStefano. Him and DiStefano had a business together in the construction industry, building motels and apartment buildings. DiStefano is a longtime outfit gangster, one of the few that was still around from the Capone era. The pseudonym that Scar had chosen, William D. Pritchard, wasn't just a random name pulled from the sky or pulled from a hat. Pritchard was an associate of Scar's, one who had done many favors for Scar in the capacity of being a private investigator of sorts. Using this fake name not only keeps police off his tail, but it also makes sure that his wife can't find him, because apparently she would come looking. So now Scar finishes up in this little hotel stay, and he goes home to his apartment. He and his wife, yeah, Beatrice, the one that he was hiding from at the hotel, go out and they have a nice meal at a restaurant. He drops Beatrice off at the door like a gentleman so she doesn't have to walk, and he goes to park the car. As he's walking through the courtyard, three dark-skinned men run out from an old beige-colored car. Apparently, he recognizes the men that are coming at him, and he screamed, "No, no," and ran in the other direction. But all three of these guys opened fire on him, and he was dead before anybody could even see what these guys look like. It happened really quick, and if you have one person that's running away from three armed men that are shooting, that person's not going to last very long. So it doesn't surprise me that it wasn't a very long encounter. His wife heard the shots go off, and she came running down. She saw him laying on the ground, and she held onto his body, screaming that they've killed my Manny. It was reported in the newspapers a few days later that it was Joey the Clown Lombardo that had actually taken Scar's life. Newspapers attributed the reason to the fact that Scar was beefing with Rocco DiStefano. They mentioned that Scar was on the verge of squealing about his interactions with Sam Teets Battaglia. They mentioned that he had told people, "I'm gonna have subpoenas all over town." That he had been bragging about his relationship with mafia bigwigs, like Felix Milwaukee Phil Aldericio, about his beef with Frank Sinatra, and a $30,000 payment that he had received in relation to a gambling joint that was half owned by Frank Sinatra and half owned by Scar, and that beef was stemming from a hissy fit that Sam Giancana had thrown in the gambling joint. Which doesn't surprise me, but apparently Giancana had started throwing tables. He's all over the place, screaming at the top of his lungs, and just generally behaving like the toddler that Giancana always behaved like. But at the same time, you could talk about beef that he had with who, what, when, where, why. At the end of the day, all roads led to Lombardo being the physical killer. As much as the papers reported it and the FBI knew it, nobody could actually put the blame on him. There was no trial, and he was never even arrested for the crime, even though everybody in America knew that he killed him. He got off scot-free, fueling him to continue committing crimes because he had already gotten away with murder, so why wouldn't he? He was a real pro when it came to managing the organization's operations, and he did it with surgical precision. What's really impressive is how he managed to stay one step ahead of the law. I mean, he had this knack for avoiding the legal system, and it was all thanks to his cunning and the outfit's influence in Chicago. This guy just couldn't be touched. 11 cases in a row that he was let off free, and he just got away with murder. He killed somebody, the newspapers knew it, the FBI knew it, the cops knew it, the public knew it, and nobody did anything about it. Every single person in America knows that he had killed Scar, but he's walking around here happy-go-lucky, waving hi to his neighbors in the morning. He's just living his life. By the late 1960s, Lombardo had made quite a name for himself within the Chicago outfit. He was one of those up-and-comers, you know, like the guys rising through the ranks and doing it astronomically quickly. Kind of like other big shots in the organization, like Angelo J. LaPietra, aka The Hook. He was on a meteoric rise as well. And as an up-and-comer, Lombardo was poised to take on even bigger roles within the outfit. He was a capo, running the Grand Avenue crew by this time, controlling businesses that are both legit and not legit. In 1971, Lombardo was handed a super important mission. He was to take over the outfit's operations in Las Vegas. You know, the city of glitz and glamour, but also the perfect place for organized crime to thrive, thanks to all those casinos and gambling joints, which is precisely why the mafia built it. So Lombardo packed his bags and headed to Sin City. And let me tell you, this is a massive turning point in his criminal career. He is now the big boss. He's in charge of everything. The casinos, the gambling operations, all of the money-making ventures on behalf of the outfit in Las Vegas is under his control. This guy had his hands on some serious cash, and his influence in the underworld is growing more and more by the day. Lombardo sends Anthony Spilotro, a member of his crew, to Vegas to watch over his interests on a daily basis because he's got some business that he has to attend to back home. He can't just disappear into the night and go off to Sin City. So he takes Spilotro, who is a trusted member of his crew, and he sends him there on his behalf, and he stays in Chicago to carry out the business that he has there. While we're here, I want to stop here and talk about another particular crime, the murder of Daniel Seifert in 1974. Daniel Seifert was a normal businessman, a husband, a father of three, and a brother. He was a friend to Joseph Lombardo, such a good friend that he would end up naming his son after him. Daniel was murdered on September 27th, 1974, by multiple masked men in his business one day. His wife, Emma, and four-year-old son, Joseph, were present when this happened. And the masked men shoved his wife and child into the bathroom while they carried out the deed. Lombardo would spend the rest of his life arguing that he had absolutely nothing to do with Seifert's death, and that he had positive proof that he had taken no part in this killing. But he would later be convicted of it, so while we're talking about it, we're gonna assume that it was him. So let's go over it and let's talk about it. On September 27th, 1974, Daniel Seifert was living a completely normal day. He and his family woke up in the morning, they made coffee, and they headed to the office so they could do a little cleaning before he began his day, so he brought his wife and four-year-old son with him. His older son, Nick, and his daughter, Kathy, went to school for the day, so it was only the four-year-old who hadn't started kindergarten yet who tagged along to the office. At the office, Emma hung around and got Joseph set up on the ground, and the four-year-old started playing with his toys. While he was doing that, his dad went out to grab something from the car. While Daniel was outside grabbing something from the car, a group of masked men broke into the back door of the building. One of the masked intruders herded Emma and four-year-old Joseph into the bathroom, telling them, "This is a robbery. We don't want to hurt you." All of these years later, grown-up Joseph is fully convinced that the man that said those words to them was Joseph Lombardo himself. He's also convinced that Lombardo was only present at the murder to ensure that he and his mother made it through this hit unharmed, since Lombardo had actually been friends with his father, Daniel, and didn't want to see his family hurt. That's actually a pretty sympathetic outlook to have on your father's murderer, so kudos to him for that one, because couldn't be me. The murderer that I want to see in prison, I would never say a good word about him, so it's cool that he's able to see through the media and come out and say, like, hey, he was actually protecting us. Even though he did kill my dad, he protected me. According to reports, the masked men grabbed Daniel and they started beating him in the office, firing a pistol in his face. But this didn't kill him. Daniel was able to get away from the masked men and he fled into a factory that was behind his office. So he went to the back door, he went out the back door of his office, and then there was an alley, and then I guess on the other side of the alley was a factory, and he went into that factory. He ran, screaming for somebody to call 911. Two men with masks on and shotguns chased him down, screaming, "Don't move or I'll shoot your head off." Finally, the gunmen ended the chase by firing three shots at Daniel, killing him instantly. As much as it seems that Seifert's assassins wanted to protect his family from seeing this murder, it didn't really work out. 4-year-old Joseph saw the fighting before he was shoved into the bathroom, and he recalls how his father was twisted up in the grass out front after he had been killed, so he saw everything. After Seifert's murder, newspapers immediately named Lombardo as the assassin. Seifert had opened his business about 7 years earlier with a few investors. He wanted to open this company, and he talked to his buddies, and what ended up happening was that Seifert put a third of the money up, with a third coming from a man named Erwin Wiener, and the third coming from Felix Milwaukee Phil Aldersirio. The trio opened up a company named International Fiberglass, and the company ended up becoming pretty successful. And that's all because of Daniel Seifert. So the second two, Erwin Wiener and Felix Aldersirio, those guys were just investors. Daniel Seifert is the one that does the actual manual labor to get this company successful at all. The mafia guys have no idea what they're doing with International Fiberglass. They have no clue. So they just made an investment and became company owners. In later years, Wiener would end up selling his third to some of his associates. And it seems like at that point, that right there, when Wiener's third was sold, is when Seifert was made aware that Aldersirio was a member of Chicago's underworld. It doesn't seem like he really knew that before this point. So now, at this point, Aldersirio, and by extension, the outfit, have 2/3 of the ownership of this company that Seifert is running and doing all the labor, but only put up a third of the money to open. After Wiener sold his share, mafia members started coming around the shop. Like, this shop now became a hangout in the mafia. And nobody really knew how it happened. And the only thing that Seifert could figure out is like, okay, Aldersirio now has 2/3 ownership. And now I only have 1/3. So he has a lot more say than I do. Aldersirio must belong to the mafia. All of a sudden, like, he wakes up the next day. And these guys that are on the front page of the newspaper every week is in his office every day. Like, it's a wild change that he never expected. Anthony Spilotro, Frank Schweiss, and Joseph Lombardo, who's the most famous of all, are regularly hanging around his shop. Now, as anybody who has actually known a mafia member in person will tell you, these guys are not guys that seem like gangsters. Lombardo, he hung around the shop. He was joking around. He's bouncing around. He's bouncing his namesake on his knee. He's bringing the second son to baseball games. Emma, who is Seifert's wife, she remembers Lombardo as a funny, very outgoing character, a clown. And as they started hanging out at the company more often, they also started to get salaries from the company, despite the fact that they didn't really do anything. But a lot of mafia guys use this tactic of getting on the payroll of a legitimate company, one for parole purposes, because when you go out on parole, you are required to get gainful employment. This is a legitimate company. They're paying taxes, which they don't do when they illegally get money. And it just shows that you're not just a gangster, you know? Like, nobody goes out into the world and they're like, oh, hell yeah, I commit crimes. I make all the money doing all the crimes. Nobody does that. Nobody. So now this is a way to say, like, hey, look, I have a job. That's where I got money. It's not like I don't make any money on the books. I make money, so that's why I drive a caddy. Lombardo became an idol to Nick, Seifert's older son. He called him Uncle Joe, and they regularly went to the circus, they went to baseball games, they did outings together, they just hung out. Everything was going fine, well, and good until 1973, when the outfit started telling Seifert what to do in his company, regardless of the fact that nobody in the outfit had any idea about anything to do with International Fiberglass. Seifert decided he didn't want to be a part of this company anymore. He couldn't do it. Like, he's the person that knows how to do this manual labor. He's been running around for years doing the manual labor, keeping the company afloat. keeping these guys paid, all to be told, like, oh, this is what you're going to do. Like, he's like, nah, I can't do it anymore. So he sold the remaining shares that he owned to the gangsters. And he went and opened his own company with his own money and no investors. This company he called Plastic-Matic. In 1974, the FBI went after Danny. And when they went after him, he agreed to testify against Lombardo, Spilotro, and Wiener in an upcoming indictment, one which was served in 1974. It soon became public knowledge that Danny would be the star witness of this indictment, and pretty much he's the only thread that the government has to tie Lombardo to the case at all. If Seifert isn't there, Lombardo's not involved in this case. And what do you think is gonna happen? The rest is history. So now the newspapers have Lombardo as having carried out this murder, but no matter. Lombardo was spending most of his time nowadays in Vegas anyway. Under Lombardo's leadership, the outfits present in Las Vegas exploded. They started getting involved in everything, not just gambling, but also the entertainment scene as well. In 1981, he had just finished a court appearance at a federal court building in Chicago. And instead of doing, like, the usual serious and solemn exit, he decided to spice things up a bit. He whips out the Chicago Sun-Times newspaper, but he cuts a hole through it so he can see through it, and he covers his face with the newspaper. A lot of people attribute this little act to something that's like, oh, it's so cute, it's silly, it's funny, oh my god, look how quirky and playful he is. But honestly, when I'm looking at those pictures, this man is just doing the same exact thing that every other gangster does when he exits a courtroom. He's hiding his face. He just did it in a creative fashion. I personally don't look at these pictures and see it as playful or quirky or anything like that. I see it as a middle finger to the media. But I don't know. You know, to each his own interpretation. People see what they want to see. That's just how I see it. I don't see this fun, quirky, oh, haha, he's so funny, what a jokester. I see it as he's making a statement like, you ain't getting a picture of me, booch. The picture of him behind the newspaper would become one of the most famous pictures ever taken of him outside of his mugshots. Lombardo was no joke. He was a really heavy hitter in the Chicago outfit. Every time that anybody is questioned about him, the first thing out of their mouths is, this guy's no clown. He's a stone-cold killer. Looking at this cutout newspaper in that light makes it feel a lot less quirky and a lot more malicious. And the media, they're just looking for a funny character trait because they're trying to play into the American idolization of the mafia following the Godfather movies. That's just not what that was. He was in charge of all sorts of illegal stuff, and he made a lot of really big decisions that shaped the entire organization's operations. This guy's no clown, and he ran the show and did what he had to do. Now, remember Tony Spilotro, the one from Lombardo's crew that he sent to Vegas on his behalf? Well, things didn't last very long between these two, and that wasn't much of a surprise. I don't think things lasted very long between anybody and Lombardo very long. Things started to peter off, and they weren't going so well in Vegas with Spilotro running the show. Tony had a brother, and both Spilotro boys disappeared on June 14th, 1986. The last place that they had been seen was driving together, leaving Michael's house in Oak Park, Illinois. They were reported missing June 16th, and the car that they left in was found a few days later in a motel parking lot. The bodies of each of the missing brothers was found on June 22nd, and they were both in their underwear, buried on top of each other in a shallow grave in a cornfield known as the Willow Slow Preserve near Enos, Indiana. And it is entirely possible that I just botched the crap out of that. I don't know how to pronounce Enos. They were actually found because a farmer had dug them up. They thought that somebody had buried the body of a deer that they had killed out of season. this farmer has no idea what's going on. Like, he sees the ground is not solid. Obviously, you can tell when a grave has been dug recently. And there's vultures flocking around this little area. And he's like, all right, I know something's there. I gotta dig it up. Most likely somebody didn't want to get arrested for having a deer that they killed out of season. So I'll just dig it up and I'll get it out of here so the vultures will go away. And all of a sudden he finds a hand. He had absolutely no idea that he was going to come upon the human remains of two of the mafia's highest ranking members in that area. It was determined that their cause of death was blunt force trauma and that they had died the day that they went missing on June 14th. So, like, yeah, it's a pretty brutal way to go. Not gonna lie to you, not the best way. But at least it was quick. It's not like they held on to them for days and tortured them or anything like that. Like, you know, you gotta look for the small silver linings. Yeah, they got beat to death, but it was quick. For all we know, they could have just gotten hit in the back of the head with a baseball bat and they didn't even know what happened. Personally, I find that super weird. I've never been hit in the head with something that knocked me out immediately. Like, you see that in the movies and it's like bonk, and as soon as someone gets hit, they knock out. I've had it where I get hit in the head and a minute later, I start feeling dizzy and lose consciousness. But never where it's like boom and then instant black. And I've gotten hit in the head pretty friggin' hard quite a few times. That's one of the main things that got me kicked out of the military was my traumatic brain injury. So anyway, Spallojo brothers, after they were disposed of, Donald, the Wizard of Odds, Angelini, was brought in to run the show in Vegas on Lombardo's behalf because Spallojo failed. Now, let's switch gears and talk a little bit about Lombardo's personal life. You might be surprised to hear that amidst his criminal activities and just being an all-around horrible person in the criminal world, Lombardo had some stability in his personal life. Back in 1951, he tied the knot with Marion Negro in a Catholic ceremony, and their marriage lasted for a really long time. They even had two kids together, showing that family values were really important to Lombardo, even in the midst of his criminal adventures. His daughter, Joanne Lombardo, was born in 1958, and his son, Joseph Lombardo Jr., was a one-time associate of the family, known as Little Joey, but he stopped being in the mafia, according to the outside world. I don't know if you ever really just stop, but according to the outside world, he stopped. He runs some mechanic or auto dealership, I don't know, some kind of car thing in Chicago. The Lombardo family lived in the same modest condo building on West Ohio Street in Chicago for over 5 decades, from the time that they got married until he became a fugitive in 2005. That's some serious commitment to one address, especially as you're growing through the ranks, you're getting richer, and especially how much you consider, like, his criminal activities are on the move. He's going here and there. He is in Vegas. He's in other places. He could easily have just bought other houses, lived other places, and he's one of the very few gangsters in the outfit that ended up staying in the city and didn't move to the outlying suburbs. Because when you get money, what do you want to do? You want to get the hell out of the city. In 1991, so 40 years after they got married in 1951, Lombardo and his wife Marion got a divorce. They went their separate ways, but here's the kicker. Lombardo stayed in the same condo building. He moved to the basement unit after the split, but he ended up staying in the same place. This would have been a perfect excuse to move, but he didn't. The unusual living arrangement raised a lot of eyebrows, and the federal prosecutors even started throwing around the idea of Lombardo having a sham divorce. There was this whole idea floating around that Lombardo's divorce may have been a sneaky way to hide his assets or any other financial shenanigans he's getting into. The feds were convinced that Lombardo was using this divorce as a smart move to stash some cash and assets under the radar. In other words, if he divorces Marion, they're not going to go after Marion's assets if his assets get seized in some kind of sting. So they're convinced this whole thing is a sham and it's just a way to protect assets so that they can't be seized if it's proven that they should be seized because they were obtained in an illegal way. Now, Lombardo's attorney, Rick Halperin, had something to say about these allegations. He basically goes out and he's like, hey, if you think it's a sham, go ahead and investigate it. And boy, did it get messy. The divorce proceedings and all the stuff around it became a really big deal. With legal scrutiny and media attention cranked up to the max, a circus trying to get a divorce. Can you imagine trying to get a divorce and everybody telling you that it's a lie? Like, to be honest, I don't believe that they really got a divorce. They were married for 40 years. Do people really divorce after 40 years? But even so, they stayed in the same building. Like, I'm sorry. I don't believe it. I fully believe that it was a way to shelter assets because they wouldn't go after her assets if his were seized. And it's not like we haven't seen mafia members do this kind of shit before, so I don't believe it, but I mean, who the fuck am I? According to prosecutors, Joseph Patrick Lombardo's wife, Marion, had sold some Florida properties for a whopping $4.5 million back in 2003. Now, this whole deal raises some eyebrows because it looks like they're trying to hide this wealth from the authorities. And we'll go over it later in part two. But the thing is, okay, so she's going out and she's selling a property for $4.5 million. And then like a year earlier or a year later, I'm not really sure, right around that time, Joseph Lombardo goes out and he's like, hey, I can't pay for a lawyer. I need the government to pay for it. And that's the reason that they're doing this. That's the reason that they're divorcing, because he's trying to play off that he's poor. He has no money. He is destitute. He needs the government to pay for everything for him. And that wouldn't be the case if he was still married to her and she had $4.5 million coming in. And that's not all. There's this thing called MJJ Trust that is thrown into the mix, and it's like another layer of complexity. It seems like they used it to shuffle around and manage their assets, which just made the entire thing even murkier, honestly. I'm not even 100% sure of what's going on here. Although they supposedly got divorced in May of 1992, it looks like the Lombardos were still living together until much, much later. So Joey Lombardo, he's like, yeah, I moved out. I moved into the basement of this condo. But realistically, like, he's going up, he's spending the night in his wife's bed. Like, he's just pretending to be living in the basement apartment to make it look like they're divorced, but they're not divorced. When they sold the properties in Florida in 2003, the documents referred to Marion Lombardo as a married woman. Now, that was like the last piece of the puzzle that just had all kinds of suspicion that something fishy is going on with this divorce, but nobody could ever prove it. So let's rewind real quick to 1982. We're back in the day and age when the Walkman had just been invented, when slap bracelets and garbage pail kids were all the rage for young kids, while high school age kids were wearing leg warmers and using 15 pounds of hairspray to make their hair as big as possible. This is also the time that Lombardo, Teamsters Union President Roy Williams, and insurance big shot Alan Dorfman faced one heck of a trial. What was their crime, you ask? They pulled off a daring bribery scheme to stop a trucking deregulation bill in its tracks. They were trying to sway Nevada Democrat State Senator Howard Cannon to block this trucking deregulation bill that was on the floor. They did not want this bill to go forward. Now, I don't know if you're anything like me, because listen, before I even go over this, let me make one thing clear. If there's one thing that I always try to do is I always try to keep these videos to the point where if you have never a day in your life heard about the mafia, you could still watch and understand these videos, which is why you'll see me explain things like the Castellamarese War or the other 100 things that I've explained 100 times on my channel and in my videos, because if you're someone that's watching my channel for the first time, I don't want you to hear something and scratch your head and be like, what? I don't even understand, and feel like you can't follow along. Or, worse yet, I don't want people to be intimidated to watch my videos because they don't have a baseline knowledge of the mafia. That's one thing that I've noticed a lot in other Mafia content creators, is that they just jump into talking about these guys and, like, things that they did halfway through their life, and you're just supposed to know all the background information about them, and if you don't, you're lost. Most of the time, I don't even know who the hell these people are that they're making videos about, but they're talking about, like, one particular crime that they pulled off, or one particular year in their life, and I'm just like, but wait, who the hell is this? Like, why should I know who this is? And I never want that to happen on my channel. So, keeping in the spirit of making sure that we thoroughly go through everything and make sure that everybody can stay on track, even if they're not Mafia wizards. So, if you're anything like me, if you heard Teamsters and you heard the 80s, even if you're not interested in the Mafia, what's the first thing that you think of? That's right, you think of Hoffa. So now, I hear this, I hear Teamsters, and I hear the 80s, and I'm like, I go looking to see if Hoffa has any involvement in this case, because, like, he has to, right? And it turns out I was right. Well, maybe not in this case in particular, but Hoffa actually stood trial with one of our three players in this little mini-story, Alan Dorfman. Now, if you're not somebody that knows who Hoffa is, he was a very famous Teamsters president. He was very involved in the 80s in, like, unions and all kinds of things with, like, labor unions and stuff. He's also probably the most famous person to ever just go missing. To this day, they still haven't found Hoffa's body. It just disappeared into thin air. And more than likely, you know, he has an anchor attached to his ankles and he's in the middle of the Atlantic somewhere, but nobody knows. And everybody goes wild. And if you're a little bit older, you remember a lot of references being made. Like, anytime anyone dug a hole for anything on TV, like in a show or something, there had to be a reference like, oh, I wonder if we'll find Hoffa.
Yeah, or Jimmy Hoffa.
I just found Jimmy Hoffa.
I think I found what I hear, Jimmy Hoffa.
They'll find Jimmy Hoffa before they...
Who? Jimmy Hoffa?
Like, it's just so famously something that's unsolved and everybody wants to find Hoffa. So, yeah, that's who he is. He's a very famous person for being involved in the Teamsters Union back in the day, and he was notoriously killed by the Mafia. And that's not me, like, looking up Hoffa and figuring... That's just, like, my baseline knowledge of Hoffa. I've never done a video on Hoffa. I've never really gone through Hoffa. I just know because, like, I'm a 90s kid and I grew up with those references. And I seen movies that he was in and I just know that he was very involved in freaking unions. I also... One of my favorite movies of all time is The Irishman. So take what you will from that. So, back to Alan Dorfman. Alan Dorfman is the stepson to Paul Dorfman, who was known as Red from The Outfit. And when you have a nickname, you know that you are connected. So his nickname is Red. We know that Red is connected. Now, Paul Red Dorfman, he is a really big deal in the unions. He's described in congressional hearings as being the link between the Chicago Outfit and the Teamsters Union. So he's very high up in the Outfit. He's listed as a kingpin. I don't know if he probably wasn't ever a boss, but he's listed as a kingpin, which means he's high up in the Outfit. And he's involved in unions. So now Red steps in 1949 because his stepson, Alan, is toiling away and he's making $4,000 a year working as a gym teacher. And he's like, I just can't watch this anymore. It's painful. I can't do it. So Red goes to Hoffa and he makes a deal to get Alan into the Teamsters insurance business. Alan works together with his mother, so now Red is married to his mother, Alan works with his mother, so this is a family affair. It wasn't like just, oh, I'm being such a great stepdad. No, like, his mom's involved, he's probably involved, and even if he's not involved, he's married to the wife, so if she's making money, he's making money. So now Alan goes to his mother, the two of them work together, and they set up Union Insurance Agency for the Teamsters. And within 5 years, Alan is a millionaire. He later opened up Amalgamated Insurance Agency, which processed insurance payments for all the Teamsters members of the unions that he was representing. This man went from $4,000 a year to a millionaire in 5 years, and that's a pretty awesome skyrocket. Like, regardless of whatever the hell else happened, you gotta give this guy a pat on the back. Like, I don't care how you did it, you went from $4,000 a year to a millionaire, and I'm giving you props for that, Alan Dorfman. You're pretty cool. Now, here's where things start to go wrong. Alan had control of pension funds, which he used to give loans to gangsters, and he would accept kickbacks to push these loans through. In other words, okay, I have control of who gets approved and who doesn't get approved for these loans from the pension fund. So a mobster comes to me and says, hey, I want a loan for $50,000. And he doesn't qualify for that $50,000, and you know he's not going to pay that $50,000 back. But he says, if you give it to me, I'll give you $10,000. And now, all of a sudden, he does qualify. He is the most qualified. Of course he's going to pay this loan back. And he walks away with $40,000. Alan walks away with $10,000. And it's all out of the government's pocket. So neither one of them lost anything and just gained in the transaction. So now, Hoffa meets Red through Santo Perrone, another outfit gangster. So they meet. Red and Hoffa become friends. And Red goes to Hoffa and he's like, hey, could you do me a favor? And Hoffa gets Alan into the union. And Alan becomes boys with the likes of Joey Glickmo, Paul DeLucia. Alan was overheard being talked about by an outfit boss on wiretaps once. And this is what he had to say about him. Alan is not that type of guy. But the people that got a piece of him are that type of guy. Alan is meek, and Alan is harmless. But the people behind him are not meek, and they are not harmless. So now, with this introduction of these new guys, Alan is now mixed up with the likes of Lombardo and Roy Lee Williams, and it all goes downhill from there. Now, this deregulation threat is still looming on the horizon, and everybody is doing everything they can to make sure that it doesn't happen. This is not just any threat. It had the potential to seriously mess with the money of a lot of really heavy hitters, including the Teamsters Union, who represented a bunch of truck drivers. Now, enter the trio of Joseph Patrick Lombardo, Teamsters Union head honcho Roy Williams, and Alan Dorfman. They are accused of offering bribes to try to influence Senator Cannon's decision in the legislature. Senator Cannon took the stand later on and said that he hadn't ever been offered a bribe, and that he had never so much as met Roy Lee Williams, so there couldn't ever be a situation where he would be offered a bribe in the first place. But according to prosecutors, there was a meeting in Cannon's Las Vegas office on January 10th, 1979, in which Roy Lee Williams, or Williams, attended, along with Alan Dorfman. And both of these men offered Cannon a really, really valuable piece of property in Las Vegas if he would work with them and help block deregulation. While Cannon claims to not know Williams, the FBI pulled out a wiretap recording where Williams is once again in Cannon's office on April 26, 1979, praising him for what he had done with deregulations. Williams bragged to some unknown third person in the office that Cannon had put him on the back burner. He got that bill out of Senator Edward Kennedy's hands. They also have a wiretap conversation where Dorfman told Cannon on May 21st of that same year, you got the property, Senator. Don't worry about it. Cannon, for his part, he just denies that these conversations ever happened in the first place. He's calling Photoshop. He's like, this is a scam. This never happened. I don't know where you got these conversations, but that's not me. I don't know what you're talking about, man. You're making this up. That wasn't me. And no matter how many, like, experts they get in that are like, I'm a speaking expert. I can tell you that that's you. He's like, nope, bribery. He's like, nope, Photoshop. Farce. I call a farce. He just will not admit that he had any part in this. This whole case got the nation's attention, and it put a spotlight on the not-so-friendly connections between organized crime, labor unions, and political corruption. Dorfman and Lombardo were convicted of bombing the home of Robert Kindler, a developer who they were trying to extort for $800,000 from this bribery case. While Lombardo was feeling good because the previous case that they had built against him, the one centered around Seifert, had fallen apart because Seifert died. And remember, I had said that Seifert was the only link that was connecting Lombardo to this case, and he killed Seifert, so now there was nothing connecting him to this case. Now, this had all fallen apart. He didn't get away with this one. The bribery conviction gave Lombardo a 15-year sentence. Now, after he gets this sentence, apparently the outfit is pissed off that Dorfman had been having candid telephone conversations with Lombardo. Meaning, like, they're starting to feel uneasy. They're really starting to feel like Dorfman is saying too much. And when somebody says too much, it's usually an indication that they may be trying to get the other person to say something that they can get on tape. So they really think that Dorfman is saying very candid things that they wouldn't say over the phone or even in person to try to get Lombardo on tape saying some shit. So they're convinced that he has flipped. He is now a witness. At one point, Lombardo was heard on a wiretap saying that Joey Ayupa, referred to as the man, one of the outfit's top-ranking leaders, is angry with Dorfman. So now, all three of these guys are slapped with very heavy sentences, and Alan Dorfman is set to begin his sentence. On January 20th, 1983, a week before he's about to report to prison, facing a possible 55-year sentence, he parks his Cadillac and he begins walking through the parking lot of the Hyatt in North Lincolnwood, walking and talking with Irwin Weiner. Remember, he's the one from the beginning. He had bought a third of that business with Daniel Seifert. So now Irwin Weiner is back in the picture. So you got Alan Dorfman and Irwin Weiner. They're walking through the parking lot of the Hyatt, and these two men are headed towards Tessie's, a restaurant in the hotel. So they're just going to have some lunch. Two men run up on them and shout, "This is a robbery." But before Dorfman has a chance to respond at all whatsoever, the men shoot him 8 times in the head with a .22. He took 5 shots to the back of the head on the left side of his head. So that killed him instantly. Sketches were only made for one of the two men, and it shows the man with a beard and having a beanie on. And there just wasn't a sketch made about the second shooter. Weiner was reported to have just stood there as Dorfman was attacked, and he was left completely unharmed. These two shooters left behind a gun, a silencer that was broken into 2, 8 shotgun shells, the license plate that they had stole last summer and put on the car to drive it there, and the body of Alan Dorfman. Okay, so now that we've wrapped up the case of Alan Dorfman, I'm going to end the video here and finish it up in part 2. Again, if you're someone who hates part 1 and part 2 videos, I'm so sorry. Don't hate me. There's a lot of information about him out there, and I know damn well you don't want to sit here and watch a 2 or 3 hour long video. If you do, then press the little icon that's about to come up when this video ends, and YouTube will navigate you right to part 2. Or it'll be in the description of this video. If you're listening on the podcast, just go to the next episode and it'll be part 2 as long as part 2 is out. Thanks so much for hanging out with me today, guys. I really appreciate it. I appreciate you being patient and not really minding that I release videos so freaking sporadically, and the fact that you guys just hang in there through the good times and the bad. I really appreciate you. I've really missed you guys, and I'm so happy that I'm back and we're gonna get back on weekly schedule. Please don't forget to like, share, comment, follow, subscribe, do all the things, and I'll see you next week. Bye.